Welcome back to Ball Year Round Podcast. As always, got a little Sunday story for everybody. Hopefully, your weekend's going well. You're not quite into the work week yet, but if you are, we appreciate you circling back to us. We got Katie Heindel on the pod today. She's a very talented writer. She works for Dime writing features currently, but we get into all that. But she was a pleasure to have on the pod. You can always follow the pod at BYRP365 on Twitter and Instagram. If you like what you hear here today, tell a friend, leave a review if you feel so inclined. Help us game the old algorithm. And let's get into the origin stories of Katie Heindel. Today, we are joined by Katie Heindel. Katie started her writing career at Vice and has since worked for Complex, UpRocks, which is also Dime, and Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment. She co-hosts the Dishes and Dimes pod and also the Basketball pod, which has a question mark at the end there if you're looking for it. And she's currently an NBA features writer for Dime, and we're excited to learn more about her journey. So without further ado, the great humanizer, Katie Heindel. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Nice. Well, we appreciate you coming on for sure. What kind of got you started in, writing and basketball, up in your Canadian, native, what got you interested and got the ball rolling for you?
Well, they existed as two completely separate streams, I think, for a long time. First, I've always been a writer. As a kid, I wrote all the time. I was a big fantasy nut. So I wrote a lot of fantasy stories as a child. And that always kind of continued. And then I did also play basketball, not necessarily well, but being tall, I feel like you get roped into these things. So I played in junior high and in high school, but I also have to preface this with in Canada, our high school basketball is totally nothing like it is in the States. So you can still be really bad and be good on a high school team. I think for me, the thing that got me into the NBA and the Raptors specifically was the team started when I was, I was in grade school, because I remember when the expansion was announced, the newspaper in Toronto, which is called the Toronto Star, ran a voting, like you could mail in your ballot of what you wanted the team name to be. Unfortunately, it was around the time that Jurassic Park came out, and I think the majority of voters were children, because some of the options were like Toronto Towers for CN Tower, Toronto Tarantulas, which is unfortunate, Toronto T-Rexes, Raptors, Terriers, I think was another one. These were like all the finalists. So I voted for Raptors because, I had just seen Jurassic Park and thought it was a sick movie. Thought that really makes a lot of sense for a basketball team, but that's probably why NBA teams no longer let children name them. But I think what was so cool about it was that, I have an older brother, and I sort of grew up wanting to do and like all the things that he did. And there was a point when I started to want to diverge from that. And not that he was even like a huge athlete or like a jock really at all, but I think basketball represented this thing I could like myself. Yeah. No one really in my family liked it. They encouraged me, like, we got a hoop in the driveway. And, I got a sick starter jacket and I got really into it on that front. But yeah, I think it was just like, oh, this is a cool thing that's starting. And we can me and my friends, we can get into it from kind of the ground up. So, my Raptors fandom, it went in and out. I feel like any fan can experience that, especially there were some pretty lean years in Toronto. I moved away for school. I went to school in Halifax and in Montreal. And in those kinds of years, the team was really not very good at all. You'd also just gone through the heartache of Vince leaving. So there was that to go off to. And I think around that time, I also was when I started to seriously consider like how I was going to fit writing into my life, and could it be a career, and how. Initially, I really didn't think so. So I've had a lot of careers. I worked for Vice. I worked in events. I like ran all the events across Canada. I've worked in publishing. I've worked in the arts. I've kind of like had a lot of careers, but I think I'm glad I did, because I always kept writing as something I was doing on the side. And I think something like that always shows you how important it is, and that, well, maybe this isn't just a hobby because I find the time to keep it up. But when I decided to start writing about basketball, like that was it's weird that it took me that long to figure it out, maybe, you know, like loving this one thing, but I guess maybe you just like, sometimes you just keep the things you love separate, mm-hmm. No rhyme or reason. But I started writing NBA fan fiction for a site called The Classical, which is now defunct, but David Roth, a defector, started that. And it was just like, I guess it was early Grantland, early Deadspin kind of vibe. So it was like both self-serious and completely not serious at all. Obviously they ran NBA fan fiction. So I wrote a lot of stories there. And then I think I'm trying to remember what the first story was where I was like, could I actually write a quote serious basketball article? You know, like, could I, cause I think, you know, also being a woman getting into this industry, one, you just see how male dominated it is. Two, there's this sense that you've always got to know twice as much as any dude, even just like casually getting into the space. And again, I wasn't really sure like where that could take me or where I really wanted it to take me. I really like creative writing, you know, and like fiction writing and literary writing, but I didn't necessarily see myself as a sports writer or how those two things could fit together. So yeah, I guess that kind of takes you to the point where they both meet.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
That's pretty awesome. I had been really put two and two together that obviously the expansion team came to an existence when you were there. So you're literally a day one Raptors fan. That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not many people can say that about what they're following along with. So you started in fantasy, that kind of started your writing process and growth. Did you have like a favorite series or favorite fantasy universe that you kind of like drew inspiration from, or?
They were like bad. These were like the like Dragonlance novels. Like these were not good fantasy novels, you know. These were like, I guess whatever the equivalent of like a dime store kind of novel is. Yeah, I didn't really even get into serious fit. Like I don't think I ever really liked, like Tolkien's fine, but it was like very dense. It was like way too dense for me, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know why I like that so much. I feel like some people, you just pick like sci-fi or fantasy, and I flipped one way.
Yes. Was there anybody that kind of helped you connect the two together? You know, kind of just discussions, or was it kind of your thoughts?
That's a really good question, and I'm actually trying to think about it. But no, I think it was that I really liked that space, the classical, because it was kind of a time like the internet is, it's so weird to say like the internet has changed, but I'm sure you guys have experienced this too, like depending on when you got online, you know, like it's gone through different iterations. And I think at that time it was like people had blogs, or like, you know, you had a live journal, or like you had whatever other platform. And so like I kept up those kinds of things, which I guess you would want to call like more confessional writing. And then deciding that basketball writing could be funny, or I think I was just like, when I would like pick storylines or things to write about, it was that I would just like, I wrote this one series about Chuck Hayes getting lost in Texas in like a like Oregon Trail style wagon, like a chuck wagon, and having to like defeat who did he have to fight? The Plumleys. In like a Wild West shootout, all because he was trying to get to, I had looked this up, like a restaurant in Houston that he really wanted to go eat shrimp scampi at. And like, I don't know why did my brain think of that? Like, why did my brain think of anything? I have another one I wrote about Paul Pierce being a vampire. That just made sense to me. So it's like picking an idea and then I guess like kind of rolling with it. But this is going to sound super cheesy, but I think like the shift into more serious writing was just the realization that like, oh, like you can still write seriously about basketball and or sports in a way that feels true to yourself. So for me, that's like not being so self-serious, you know, and that's like finding like, what is it about Paul Pierce that made me think of him as a vampire, you know? Or like, what is it about
all those elbow jumpers?
Like, what was it about Chuck Hayes that made me feel like he's this kind of forlorn character? Like there are these, there are real things that kind of ran through all those. I started writing for like seriously about the NBA for Raptors Republic, which is just like a Raptors fan site basically. And Blake Murphy was the editor at the time. And I remember emailing him, like cold emailing him and just being like, could I... Now I think it's so funny because I know how that site works and I was like way too formal. But I was just like, you know, I'd like to try something. He was like, cool. Yeah. Like send me an article and we'll see how it goes. And I guess it went fine. So I guess I definitely have to credit Blake as just someone who like gave me the opportunity and kind of gave me the chance, to get in there. But I think right away I realized like the way that I write in the style that I write, which I think I fought at first because, you know, both of you, I'm sure realize like a lot of sports writing is pretty formulaic. And I think there's a lot of pressure to fit into the bounds of that. And if it doesn't look like it, then is it right? Or is it serious? You know, will people take you seriously? But I think the advantage I had was I was coming from it again, from like all these other careers in different worlds where I just had like real life and real work experience. So I'd never, maybe it's because it didn't feel like there was so much riding on it at the time, especially I was working, like I always had an other regular job, you know, and I wasn't trying to like figure out what my entry point into sports media was all at once. You know, that was something that kind of came gradually. And I could navigate that gradually, I think, with also like a different sort of confidence, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I think like you're saying, like, you know, writing is just a form of entertainment at the end of the day too. It should be insightful, but also entertaining and, you know, having a funny spin on it. Like I'm picturing Chuck Hayes. He had that free throw tick where he kind of moves his foot.
And yes.
I'm picturing him in a shootout now in the middle of an Applebee's or whatever, trying to get his shrimp scampi. And he's doing his little foot tick before he's shooting the, you know, Plumlee on the other end there. But when were you at Raptors Republic, Blake, and with Blake Murphy? Was that in college or just after?
That would have been, a few years after. So when I moved back to Toronto after school in Montreal, I transferred to school in Montreal to go to school for creative writing. It was a program that Concordia offered. So I did that for 2 years. I didn't really like it because I had also taken a couple years off before I went to university. And I moved around a lot and I just like, I don't know, had a lot of, I guess, real life experiences. And I feel like creative classes that are more like tutorial based or workshop based, you get a lot of value out of them depending on who's in your class. And like a lot of, you know, not to knock the kids in my classes, but they were a lot younger than me. It was kind of their first time away from home. And just like the things we wanted to write about were not the same. And I thought like, oh, I'm not really sure what I'm kind of gaining from this. So when I moved back to Toronto, I was like dead set on leaving right away. I thought I'd stay for a summer and move to New York or something, because I had a lot of friends doing that at the time. I got an internship at Vice that turned into a different job. I wrote at Vice as well while I was there, which was, I think, helpful in terms of like, that's where I did a lot of my first interviews. Granted, those were like with bands, you know, or like with entertainers and really not in the realm of sports. Like this was pre-Vice Sports as well. I'm trying to think of the Raptors team, like what the roster was when I first approached, because that sometimes like helps you frame time better. Yeah. I mean, it was early. It was like Amir Johnson was still on the team. Patrick Patterson was still on the team. And I think it was around the time where I was circling back to the Raptors in a more interested way. There was like this kind of hopeful current running through the team. A lot of that I do like put stake in DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry kind of deciding like, this is going to be our team now. And Masai Ujiri getting there and it feeling a bit like a sea change, or just, it made you feel like you wanted to sit up and pay attention to it. So I think probably seeing that made me feel like this could be like a really interesting kind of conduit to follow. I don't know. The way that this sounds is that I've done a lot of things and haven't necessarily thought them all through, but I feel like that's not always the worst way to approach things, especially if you're curious, you know, and a creative person. It's not the worst thing to take risks and to try things.
No, definitely. And that's something too, like, you know, just with the people that are listening a little bit, like, you see that a lot where people, you know, are unsure, you know, should I make this move? And, you know, they second guess, but, you know, you got to go through it to be able to know. So I think that, you know, that's phenomenal advice and, you know, people can take and be like, you know what, this is a point in life right now, especially with what's all going on, like, take that chance. Mm-hmm. It might actually turn into something that you want. So mm-hmm. Awesome to hear.
Yeah. And I think like there's a lot of pressure too, to that point, like, just because you take the chance, it doesn't mean you have to. You can still do things on the side, you know, or like take a chance and see how it feels, feel it out first before you like throw the rest of like whatever it is you're doing away, you know. Like, you can, we get so hung up on like the process isn't really linear, right? And I think we get so hung up on like, one, like, how do you know when you make it, or like, how do you know when you're successful? And like, these are all things that you have to determine for yourself, especially as a writer, because it's very solitary thing, right? Like, you have to kind of recalibrate and like set your own goals, and those, the timing of those, sometimes it can feel like you're making no progress, especially if you start comparing yourself to other people and other people's successes. So I think the thing to remember is like, you just have to sometimes have to try things, and like sometimes those will be dumb things and they won't work out, but like that's like the fastest and best way to learn what it is you actually want to be doing.
Definitely. Yeah, I think it's a creative exercise too, like you're saying. You know, I find a lot of the like analytics, you know, I love analytics, but a lot of the articles, like you're saying, it, you know, people fitting into this kind of box kind of thing, like a lot of the articles you read today are a little bit boring because of the amount of numbers that are in them. So I really appreciate the, you know, the approach from a fantasy writer kind of start and creative aspect that goes into your, you know, your features and your pieces and even your podcasts too. So that's definitely appreciated. But what was Vice is a pretty interesting place. I've always been kind of a fan. As a kid, I found the Vice YouTube channel and deep dove the whole world via it. what was that like? Did you ever have any sort of like super out there pieces thrown on your desk, or were you more in like the band realm? I know they do a lot of music stuff too.
I mean, it, like, the work experience of it was weird, because when I got a job there, like the Toronto office, there was only five or six people in the whole Toronto office when I first started. And then it grew into this, like, you know, few hundred people by the time I left. And I was an intern. I was doing really dumb shit for like stories, because, you know, at the time you're like, oh, this is funny. Like, that's just how much like Vice, the like narrative was just like, what's funny and like, what's dumb. And now it's like, would I do those things now? No. But like at the time, it just kind of felt like that was the tone of things. I'm trying to think. I did like the worst and probably most like painful thing I did was I got really interested in competitive eating competitions while I worked there. And I was like, how hard is this? And interviewed a couple people who did that competitively. And then my editor at the time was like, why don't you try and eat like as many pickles as you can in like a single sitting? And we did that and it did not go well. And I wrote about it. So that I only really ended up hurting myself.
How many pickles?
Yeah,
I'm trying to think. It was bad.
Were these sliced? Were these dill spears?
They were like full.
Okay,
like the dill.
The Vienna jumbo dills, kind of. Oh,
yeah, okay. They were large. They were pretty big, and I don't know, I want to say either between like 14 to 17, I threw up a lot.
Oh, no.
It was very bad. Yeah. But yeah, predominantly like at that time, I was really like, I was writing about music first. And then I wrote a lot about Canadian politics when Vice sort of shifted over into news. And I guess that was like the benefit of being at Vice at that time, was like, it was everything. Like, it wasn't anything yet that you couldn't say like, well, I want to write about this either dumb thing one day and then this kind of like more serious thing the next day, depending on what was going on at that time too. Like, I was also starting to get more into the events world, so that predominantly was like shows for music festivals like across Canada, so music and writing sort of fit in tandem together. It was funny to come back to Vice when Vice Sports actually started, because that was only a vertical that existed in the States. And that was when David Roth was the editor there. And I met a lot of people that I now consider like friends through that site. And it was like, I think one of the last places where you could have that, like, not totally self-serious sports writing go hand in hand with, like, you know, your more analytics approach, but the tone was always a little bit different than what you see now. Yeah, I don't know. It was a weird place. It was like my first job out of college. It was a place I always thought I wanted to work. I can't say it was like, it wasn't the best experience. Like, it wasn't the worst experience. The pay was really bad. There was like no HR department. You were like working with your friends. But like at that time in my life, you know, I'm in my early 20s. It just like, it felt like, oh, this seems like a cool thing. I didn't necessarily know where it would take me or what I wanted to do, but I was just kind of riding the wave.
So you said you dabbled in politics a little bit there. The only thing I know about Toronto politics is Mayor Rob Ford. Did you happen to cross paths with that enigma, if we could say kindly, I guess?
rest in peace, Rob Ford. No, I wrote about him, but we never crossed paths because I was also not like a city beat reporter. And like, yeah, I'm kind of glad.
Do you remember the feature?
What did we do? I think it was pretty critical. You know, I think it was like, that's something I guess that's run through a lot, or politics or music. I think like being critical is like a good thing to be, you know, in caucuses or fandom and, you know, the sport itself. But I'm trying to think. So
unfortunately, there's been quite a bit of subject matter in the last 12 months for fandom behavior and potential league decisions. But
yeah, exactly. No, I think it was just like more generalized politics. Canada, I wrote about like federal politics too. And at that time, Canada had a more conservative government running it. So, you know, like social services were getting cut, healthcare was getting cut, things that I think are pretty important to the Canadian identity, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wouldn't say they weren't the best things I ever wrote. They were mostly just blogs, you know, but it definitely helped me cut my teeth in that world.
And that, I mean, Vice, I know, kind of gives a bit of freedom, and that probably was good to kind of exercise those creative muscles and be able to make mistakes and just keep it pushing. And so that's always good. Penguin, is that the publishing house that you were working for a second there?
Yeah. So I went on from Vice when I was kind of like, you know what, this was a fun run. You know, it was like maybe 7 years or so, and I did a little bit of everything and I really liked it, but it was to the point where it was like, but also like I wanted an HR department. I wanted a little bit more structure. I would have liked a raise. So like things that I think when you start to realize your value and autonomy within a job, and that it's not necessarily going to reflect in the job that you have or that you like, and maybe you need to look elsewhere. Again, I think this was also clearly now retrospectively, it was me circling around to writing again and figuring out the way that how and if that could fit into a career. So yeah, Penguin Random House in Toronto, worked there for about 2.5 years. I was the executive assistant to the president and publisher, which was a very interesting experience because I ended up working extremely closely with all the publishing heads of every imprint that Penguin Random House owns. And these are some of them was like established publishers, editors, kind of not just even in Canadian publishing, but globally. Met a lot of authors. Talked to Salman Rushdie once for a really long time in an elevator. Margaret Atwood, like those kinds of, you know, like these were just, it was an interesting world to be in. But I soon realized that in that space, like unless you were trying to fast track to become an editor, one, it was also a situation where there was like not that many jobs. So there weren't that many opportunities because people who wanted to be editors started as like interns and junior editors, then editors, and you couldn't really kind of come in. You had to really like stake out your spot. You know, people were a little bit cagey. I met some of like the best people I've ever met, I think, in the history of like my career history there, who I'm still friends with. But I realized pretty soon, like, this isn't going to help me. This isn't going to fast track me anywhere as a writer. If anything, sometimes it was also a little bit depressing because you got to see behind the curtain about sometimes there's like really no rhyme or reason as to why something gets published and something else doesn't. You know, sometimes it's just like, it's just straight up nepotism like anywhere else. Right. Which was as a writer was a bummer. Cause so I've started to feel like my dream die and like wither a little bit. So I made a jump to get out. I worked at like an architecture firm immediately after that, which was interesting, as kind of like an in-house writer, almost like on the comm side of things. And I think there, that was the first time I like really tried to, you know what, I was like, I'm going to just pick a place. And this is still something I do, like in terms of trying to get bylines and set goals. But I was like, you know, I've always wanted to write for Rolling Stone. I'm going to pitch them. I'm going to think about what it is I can pitch them in a, like for basketball, for sports. And I'm just going to do that and we'll see what happens. And I did end up publishing a story that I think it was about the kind of the basketball arms race and like looking at super teams and why overall it was good and kind of an accelerant for the league at the time. And that just felt like, it felt like a hurdle, like clearing a hurdle. And then I think that was when I realized, okay, this is like, it felt so good and it felt like something really attainable. And it was sort of the proof I needed, I think, to look at that much more seriously. I should say that at that point too, I had been writing for Raptors Republic for maybe about six or eight months or something. And then I realized like, oh yeah, the scope can broaden here. So let's sort of like chase this and see where it goes.
Yeah, that's awesome. Definitely. And there was there anything like too, like, you know, that you would kind of, you know, tell yourself as you're going through these, that time, you know, where things weren't looking as good for you, but you, you know, still told yourself and, you know, maybe some positive self-talk, you know, just being in that industry where it's like a lot of pressure, you know, it seemed, you know, to have the right piece so that you could move on. Was there anything that you did to kind of keep yourself grounded and level?
I think it was around that time, like I had a string of jobs where I either got fired or I would just like fall really quickly out of interest with them. And now I can say like, yeah, I probably deserve to get fired. Like I wasn't that interested in working for like an arts not-for-profit, you know, like it wasn't where clearly my head was at, but I think it took me a little bit longer than I would have liked to admit at the time that that's something I should have keyed into and paid attention to and maybe like made this jump that I'm talking about a little bit sooner. Granted, like you also can't beat yourself up. Sometimes you're just not ready to do that, right? Sometimes it takes a few hard lessons to do it. And I think again, like I met a lot of people through those jobs and I like had a lot of real life experiences and failings in work. And I think like established a lot more like people skills and networking skills, which are now like so valuable being in the sports world, because all it is talking to people and meeting people and forging connections with people and, you know, getting people to want to talk to you and not just being like a really curt beat reporter, like shoving a mic in someone's face, you know, and asking them like what they thought of the foul that they got in the third quarter or something like that, especially for the kind of work that I do. So I think at that time, yeah, things just like weren't necessarily as clear as they would become. I mean, retrospectively, everything is very clear. But I was just still, I was very uncomfortable. And I think I was trying to find the job that would make me comfortable. And it took a little while to realize like, oh, that's not going to be, that's not going to be a 9-to-5 job. Or like that can no longer be a job outside of this interest, which was basketball writing and basketball that had then kind of consumed me and taken over. And like, that's where I looked. And that's where I felt like I had the most momentum. It made me feel the best. I cared about it. I was meeting some really incredible people. And I think it was just, again, like this world I really wanted to explore. And once it started to eclipse, like, you know, yourself, like, you know, when something starts to eclipse everything else and when you should start listening to the voice in your head, that's like saying, oh, like, maybe you should pay attention to this. Like this seems like it could go somewhere. So, I mean, I think I had a couple hard lessons and like ego bruises, but I don't think I would have taken the jump without a lot of those more severe pushes.
Right. No, definitely. And that's huge too, because like you say, it's, you know, taking those times and actually learning from them, you know, because a lot of people, that's the hardest part, is admitting at times like, man, okay, hey, this wasn't right, but now I know kind of where I want to go with it. And the fact that you took that leap, I'm happy you did. You know, some of these pieces have been phenomenal. And like I said, I really like your podcast. And, you know, the story is just the fact that you keep, you know, constantly improving. Like I've always seen, like have seen through the whole thing is awesome. And I hope people are able to take that and be like, man, like start setting some goals And, you know, it seemed like once you set that goal, you put your mind to it with Rolling Stone. So that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, that's definitely a shoot your shot kind of moment kind of thing. And like you're saying, you always kind of had another job. So it wasn't like a desperation thing until you were felt like you were ready to pull the trigger on something as big as a Rolling Stones kind of proposal article or proposing to them for an article. You spent a little time, one of your 9-to-5-er kind of jobs for a second there that wasn't quite writing, was at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And you were involved in like events again, kind of similar to the beginning of your Vice career, I guess. What was that like, you know, working at a MCOA in Toronto, or MOCA rather?
It was fun. I mean, I was like, cool, I work at a contemporary art museum now. like, they basically brought me on. So MOCA in Toronto, I should say, like MOCA existed. It's like existed since the 80s, early 90s, but it was in a different space. Then they had like a real, they closed. That space closed because of like in a lot of cities, Toronto's undergoing a real development boom. So, you know, buildings and spaces are getting bought up, turned into condos, like gentrification is kind of running wild. So their old space, which is on Queen West, which is like one of the quote cooler streets in Toronto, got bought up and was getting turned into condos. So MOCA didn't have a home. And then they moved into, it was about like a 7-story, like converted building that was used to be a factory, like a classic, I think they, it was like a steel factory. Developer, they just wanted to move MOCA into it. They had a real rough start. Like they had a few false starts. It took a long time for things to get off the ground, but MOCA hired me basically to first do their opening events. So like it was like a week long series of reopening and kickoff events that I had about a month to plan. But at that time I was really looking for something to just throw myself into completely. Events is really hard work because you never see your family and friends again, because you just work. People are like, but it's so fun, you get to party. And it's like, no, like you're at the party, but like you're not partying and like you're not really enjoying yourself because you're usually on site from like 5 a.m. to like 4 a.m. once the event is over. But it was something I knew how to do. I was curious to like try it out in a new space. I do love art and the arts and like contemporary art. So I thought, oh, like this could be a cool opportunity. Again, I think just like throwing myself into something at the hope of seeing like if it would stick. I did really like it. It was a really small team. Like it was a lot of people who cared very deeply about what they were doing. The arts in Canada is really, it's like one of these kinds of professions that's like guilts you into expecting less because it's the kind of onus is on you being like, but you're an arbiter of culture. Like you're bringing contemporary art to the city, you know? And it's like, okay, so can you pay me like a fair wage or not? Like, so that was like another thing where I was just like, yeah, this isn't necessarily worth the time. And I also found like, I think this was the first time I realized like I was starting to get invited to panels for basketball. I was having a lot more speaking opportunities. I was getting on the radio. I was getting invited to podcasts. Like I was expanding where I wrote for. It wasn't just Raptors focused anymore. I was like shifting a wider lens to the NBA. I was getting bylines in other places. And it started to like interfere with my job basically. Cause it's like, well, I can't do an event one night, you know, and like, what if I have this panel to go to? So I started to see like where I always knew I would shift into it, or like I knew I always wanted to, but I think it was waiting for that moment to like make the jump. And this was a situation where, again, like that was clearly being shown to me by some other force of like, you could do it right now, but I wasn't necessarily ready. And all that said, like, it's probably one of the funniest places I've ever worked. Like working in contemporary art, where like one of the exhibitions that we had when I worked there was like this huge dead ash tree that weighed like 300 tons or something. And it was like brought in piece by piece. And the exhibit was basically that scientists in tandem with the Royal Ontario Museum. So like our natural history museum in Toronto would come in and dissect the tree, find bugs, live bugs in the tree. There would be like educational aspects to it. But I remember the funniest thing about it was like the floor that the tree was on wasn't proofed. So like it's, you know, the whole 2 weeks after the tree arrived, when things started to warm up, all these ants and like insects and crazy flying bugs hatched and like moved out of the tree and moved their way onto other floors of the museum, into our office space. No. And I should say that like the museum also didn't own the whole building. Like there were restaurants, there were offices. Mm. So people were just like finding ants everywhere. You know, there was like a funny learning curve in that. Cause again, like the, like our people, and I don't want to knock it because like people who work in arts in Canada care very deeply about it. You kind of have to, like, I think that's what gives it any staying power for you. But again, it was something that I came to that I was like, this is like, I can take a casual approach in that it wasn't a be all end all for me. So like, maybe I could find like some of the funnier, like human interest stories in the place. But yeah, I think by the end of it, I just felt super burnt out. Like it was coming off a stretch of like the museum needed to make money. We had to pick up on like a lot of revenue. So events were kind of like what we tried to ramp up. We're trying to have like weddings in a space that just like was not equipped for it. Weddings, galas, like, you know, DJ nights, like parties. It's all things I had done before, like in an event sense, but it didn't necessarily fit the space. Also because you have to always tell drunk people like, please don't, like contemporary art, you're like, oh, it could just be a trash can, right? And someone's like, no, I'm gonna throw my trash in that trash can. And you're like, that's art, don't touch it. So it was like not the best space for that kind of stuff. But yeah, that was, I'd say, that was like one of the last full-time 9-to-5. Well, it was more than 9-to-5, but like full-time jobs I had before I switched over completely.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, you know, you've done well with, you know, your passion project side gig when it takes over your 9-to-5. That's kind of everyone's, you know, dream to do that kind of thing for sure. Make that happen. I mean, the petrified wood thing, that is hilarious. How, I mean, I imagine you have a building full of things that are fragile and probably can't handle a bug infestation. And you're bringing a big old tree that's just full of bugs. That's amazing.
Yeah, you have a lot of other, like, you know, to the artists that made them, I'm sure, like, priceless works. You have, like, the air, you have, like, the ventilation system in the building. Also, you have, like, your electrical system in the building. Yeah, you have all those other systems that are now, like, literally crawling with bugs.
Yeah, imagine once, you know, the hatchlings get in there and make more hatchlings, it's kind of hard to purge the building. That is brutal.
So I think it's like a cool thing that they did, but they approached basically different like freelance writers and asked them to pick a month of the regular NBA season because they wanted to have this like rotating cast of feature writers. I think it was something that they were curious to try out with just like, it was all for online, like it was all for their website, but just to like get different voices, more diverse voices within that space. I also think it probably had to do with budget rather than like keeping someone on staff, but it was a very, it was something that at the time, like I couldn't, I was like, oh, like this feels like a jump. You know what I mean? Like, this is actually like, we want to talk about what we said earlier, like, you know, no one's going to tell you when you found success, but for me, that was a real measure of it. So I picked February because like secretly in the back of my head, I was like, if I can go to All-Star, I'm going to pick the month where I can go to All-Star. But it ended up being like, I was at another job, like after Mocha, really bad job. But I had already like planned to kind of leave it maybe in December, because I got that opportunity. And again, I think I could have probably left it a lot sooner, but whatever, like, you know, you kind of like pick and choose your signs where you find them. And yeah, when February rolled around, I was just like, this is it. Like, I'm going to just use this month as the push and kind of jumpstart into like doing this full time. You know, I had kind of reached out to the editors I'd worked with, try to negotiate, you know, what could be living. Cause this was also like me collecting income piecemeal from a lot of different outlets. Right. So like trying to budget, like, well, what do I need to live, you know? And also like your payments as a freelancer do not come in like on the first of the month. Like they come in, you chase them down, they come in at really strange times. Like you just have to kind of squirrel away money all the time because you never know when your next payment is going to actually arrive. Also because of just like all the systems, like every, I work for Canadian outlets, I work for American outlets, like they all use different systems of payment. So But I thought, like, all right, this is at least going to represent like a solid month of work and meeting people and making connections and like getting into a kind of rhythm of like covering not just that team regularly, but like teams that came in, you know, came in to play Toronto. I got to go to All-Star, which was incredible. And then the pandemic happened.
Yeah, it was right
pretty after. Much soon after. So at that point, I was just like, what is this? You know, like, you know, you choose to make the jump and then, oh, like the entire world basically shuts down. But mm-hmm. I think by that point, I was just like, well, I'm not going to go. One, you couldn't necessarily go back to other jobs, because I look at it now as like all those jobs I worked in, like events, are now kind of non-existent, right? They certainly were not existing like during the pandemic, and now they'll be slow coming back, if at all. So more than likely, I probably would have got laid off. So, you know, I didn't regret the choice that I made, because who's to say that those other jobs would have existed, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that after that, I mean, it weirdly worked out, because I think the momentum I'd gained in that month building up in terms of just like meeting people and reaching out and talking to people and the things that I had set up for after all still worked out, because like, you know, games stopped for a little while, but again, like the kind of writing I do, which is more like personal and like human interest stories, right? Mm-hmm. More like features on like the landscape of the league and the changes that are happening in it. Sometimes about like the politics of the game, like those things are ongoing. They don't need basketball games to exist. So I found that period of like first lockdown, you know, from like when the NBA shut down to probably that first summer, was like some of the busiest and like some of the most meaningful interviews and stories I've ever written. Like in that period, I interviewed Stan Van Gundy, which was like a dream of mine. Yeah. Like I have such a soft spot for that man. I interviewed Becky Hammond, you know, like I interviewed Jenny Bissek. Like I got some of the biggest player interviews, like phoners too, because everybody else was stuck at home. So like the opportunities just kept arriving, and I had finally cleared out the space and the time for them.
Yeah, definitely. Was that technically under 111's kind of umbrella?
No, 111 was the last job I had before, but it was a writing job. 111 I got because the woman who like headed up that space is since closed. She was a writer herself. She's a big Raptors fan, and she knew me from my basketball writing, and she was trying to start a program where they would have a writer in residence. It's a tech incubator. So it was a Canadian tech incubator that housed something like, you know, they had over like 100 tech startups who couldn't necessarily afford their own space, like offices. So they would come in there, they'd raise funding to launch, you know, like at all different stages. And then the best case scenario is they'd start their company and they'd leave. She wanted to bring writers in that were from all different backgrounds. So the first writer that she brought in was more of like a culture writer for a few like Canadian lifestyle magazines. And then she wanted to bring in me, like she wanted to bring in a sports writer, because she just thought like, this is more interesting than having someone who is familiar with the tech world, because it meant that you had to like, I loved it because I could interrogate stories and learn a lot about a world I really knew nothing about, you know, on a peripheral level. And again, it was just like, these are all just people, like these are all human interest stories, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like at night I would be covering games, and like there was space to do both. So I loved that, because I was like, oh, this is cool. Like I could be a writer and have a job as like a writer in residence somewhere and still be doing basketball writing. Like, because I've never thought of it as like, I only want to be a basketball writer. Like I still do other writing. Basketball writing is certainly what I spend most of my time doing, but I never wanted it to be a limiting thing. So it was incredibly cool. And then unfortunately the entire place got shut down pretty much. Like it was supposed to be a month long posting, and I think I made it about 3 weeks. And it wasn't just like me getting let go, like the incubator shut down, like the people that were funding it pulled the funding and that was it, which sucked, because that was also like the hopes and opportunities for like however many hundreds of people, you know, like had invested in that space and were depending on that space to launch their businesses. So that kind of sucked, but I do feel like everybody's got a story like that because of the pandemic.
Definitely, definitely relatable. And I think, you know, and you kind of had your big moment going to, you know, All-Star weekend and having all those amazing experiences races, I'm sure. And then obviously the pandemic happens and mm-hmm. you end up at a pretty decent landing spot in that tech incubator. And again, getting to flex and, you know, flesh out your creative writing and, you know, exercise that kind of part of the brain a little bit more and spice it up, change it up a little bit. But then that closes down. So you got kind of two doors shut in like almost 60 days or less. Like,
yeah.
What was that like? Like, how did you, you know, kind of adapt and reassess what direction you were heading in? Or was it just, you know, full speed ahead on, you know, the basketball, you know, and podcasts and all that stuff?
I mean, it's certainly sucked because like to feel that momentum building and then to get the payoff of All-Star and like that month of just like being so close to a team was like the first glance at being like, this is what I want to do. Like now I'm finally doing it full time. And like, this is what I've wanted, you know, kind of since this little idea got planted in my head and like was really nagging and wouldn't go away. So I think at first I was mostly worried about that, like what would happen to that momentum and how would it carry on. I knew I would continue writing because I didn't have something necessarily related to gameplay. But I also think at that point, there was a little bit of a grace period because like everything was messed up, you know, and like everybody's lives stopped. And I think the challenge was in trying to not take that. So not spiral so deeply into panic, you know, while also just like trying to maintain some semblance of a routine. And for me, like writing certainly helped with that. And it's like always been something that I've formed a routine around. So yeah, I guess, like at that point, I think it was more of just like, you know what, I'll just treat this sort of a one day at a time thing and, you know, produce stories to the best of my ability. And like I said, like, you know, I kept getting interview opportunities. They were over the phone. I think it was one of the more interesting times I've ever either spoken with players or team staff or coaches or anyone I ended up speaking with for a story because everyone was so same place. So, you know, you want to talk, we talked about like being an equalizer coming in. I think that at that point, it really was for a lot of people because everybody's lives just sort of stopped. And I think the thing that I ended up missing the most, and I experienced this again, really like thankfully for the first time in such a long time at Summer League, was the in-person opportunities of like covering a game and being in that space, not just for the opportunities of like getting to talk to players and watch basketball in person, but also I think for the opportunities to like talk to your friends, to like network. Like the best thing about a basketball game is like you literally never know who you're going to run into in like the hallway, like the arena tunnel, the hallway, like on the court. Like I remember like one of the best conversations I had was like I was writing a story on Tim Hardaway Jr. and I wanted to talk to Rick Carlisle, but I didn't necessarily want to talk to him in his scrum because he's like, I don't know, he's like he can be a bit grumpy. And he's like a pretty severe man. Like he's a little bit intimidating, but like Rick was just standing on the court, like the side of the court. I had come out late to watch warmups and I looked and I was like, is that, and he was alone. No one was talking to him. And I just went up to him. Cause again, these are opportunities where it's like the rush of it and being like, he could tell me to just like F off and like get lost and leave him alone. But the fact that he was just there, like I just went up to him and was like, can I talk to you about Tim? And he was like, what do you want to know? And like, he loves Tim. Like he wanted to talk about him so much. And I think it was just like catching him out of context, you know, and like catching him with no pressure and nobody else around. Like I ran into, that's how I met like Doris Burke and like almost puked all over myself. Like it's like generated a lot of opportunities that every time I left, I felt like, if this makes sense, I felt like I was getting somewhere in my career. Whether that's because I met someone or just like something interesting had happened, or I had an idea for something like a story down the road. And I think it was like, as a writer, again, you just do that by yourself. Like you're just alone in your house writing. There's not a lot of social, there's no social aspect that you would get with like a day job, you know, like you don't have people kind of saying like good work or like that was great. You know, you don't have a lot of ways to track your progress, but I think pairing that with being able to cover and go to games to me always felt like, this is like the tangible part of it. And this is what I feel like, where I feel like I is like a measuring stick for progress. And then I go away and do the work alone. But that balance felt really crucial to me, and to not have that part of it. Like, and I really want to stress, it's not just like, it's really cool to go and cover games, but it wasn't just that. It was more of like the feeling that I would come away with every time, that I was making some headway and like making some progress. Again, I feel like in any sports media job, so much of it is like you have to set your own goals and decide what's success for you, because if you compare yourself to other people, you're just going to get super depressed and like realize, you know, your path's not going to be the same as someone else. But like having that in-person stuff taken away, we were all just like living in the vacuum of online, right? And all you see is other people being like, I did this. And that became a, like a difficult thing to balance. So that part I will say was pretty tough.
Sure. Yeah. You know, kind of what you talked about though with the summer league and, you know, meeting people and, you know, people at that time, it seems too, like people are more open to talk, you know, if you catch them at the right time, like you're saying. When you're saying that, was there like who's the most interesting person you kind of talked to and what made them interesting?
At summer league or just in general?
Just, I would say even in general, you know, just throughout your years.
I'd say, actually, Tim Hardaway Jr. ended up being a really interesting player to talk to, because the story of him was more of just like how he's like not the flashiest player. Like he doesn't put up the biggest numbers, but he became really integral to the team in a much quieter way. And especially around that time, you have Doncic and like Porzingis, and like that's where the focus was. But like what he was doing just struck me as really like resilient, you know, and like he's super measured. But he didn't want to talk pregame, because a lot of players have, they kind of like, they might go to chapel or they'll listen to music. Like they have routines that they follow pregame pretty exclusively, I think, you know, superstitiously sometimes. And he didn't want to talk. So I was like, all right, cool. I got to talk to him after the game. And they lost so badly. Like the Raptors really beat them and he did not have a good game. So I remember going into the locker room and he was like flipping out. Like he was like swearing and yelling and just like, even his teammates were ignoring him and no one wanted to talk to him, but I was like, well, I have to, like, I've already like decided, like I told my editor, this is a story I'm here to cover. Yeah. And I was just like, do you have a minute now? And he just like switched, like he just went like pure pro, like completely pro mode, like so calm. And like, it was a great interview, you know, and he thanked me at the end of it. And I was like, all right. You know, that I think just went to show me that like sometimes it's good to be yourself uncomfortable and a little bit scared, because sometimes that's just like when you're going to get the best things out of people. Who else? Lonnie Walker was a really good interview, because during the middle of it, Pop reached over my shoulder and like zipped up Lonnie. Lonnie had this like beautiful red leather jacket on. Lonnie's like really like good, like a really, really good fashion sense. And then Pop, yeah, he reached over, he like zipped up the jacket and he was like, you gotta show me how to dress like you. And Lonnie was like, there's no hope for you, but like we'll try, you know. And I have it, like I recorded it, I was recording the interview at the time, but just like Pop was like just laughing, he knew I was recording, and like we were kind of all riffing together, and it was just like getting to see this inside sort of the microcosm of the team and like how it is that guys interact. And I think probably the most recent one, though this was remotely, like over like a Zoom scrum, but was like getting to ask Lowry. I think I was one of the last people to ask him a question as a Toronto Raptor. And I just asked him about like role models, because so many of the guys on the Raptors like saw Kyle as a role model. So I asked him like who he ever had as a role model growing up and why he takes that like role so seriously. And, you know, Lowry gets like a really bad rap as being this kind of cantankerous player who doesn't want to talk to people, you know, who's like a hard interview or a quote, bad quote, which is a term I really hate. But he talked at length so much. I cried. It's on, like, it's recorded. It's on YouTube, but you can hear me when I'm like, thanks, Kyle, like choking up. Cause it was just like, it was such a meaningful answer. And I think it was just one of those points that to me cemented that like, yeah, guys aren't bad. Like people aren't bad quotes. Like people are people. You could have a bad day. You could just get asked like a bad question, you know, or like these guys as anything else, like they go into work mode. Like they kind of like, you get used to answering the same questions and like there's a rhythm to that. So I think learning to disrupt that was something that I enjoyed the most, you know. I don't want to talk about it in the past tense, but like games haven't come back yet, so we'll see. But yeah, I mean, I guess the thing all these have in common is like they kind of lift the curtain a little bit and you get to see in like the lives of someone and like their personality come out. But yeah, I don't think I've ever had a really, I've been lucky, like I've never had a really bad interview. you. The worst interviews I ever had were at All-Star when you have to like scream over 70 people trying to ask someone a question. That sucks. And you're not going to get the same answers, you know, that like you'd want to, but that's just situational. But yeah, I think I've always like really enjoyed every conversation I had. Once I went to talk to Kyle O'Quinn, he was opening up a birthday card. He was so happy, you know, the like smile that he had, like, oh, he's yeah. like such a beautiful, like megawatt smile. And he was smiling like crazy. I talked to Miles Turner once about Fleetwood Mac, who he like roadied for once, like in Australia one summer. Like, I don't know. It's just like, it's fun to talk to people, like to talk to these guys as people. And I think it's like a refreshing, I mean, I hope it's a refreshing thing for them too.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, it must've been pretty surreal kind of following Kyle Lowry's career. You probably never would have guessed that you were going to be the person to ask his last question officially as a Raptor kind of thing and have such a, you know, an impactful kind of answer come from it. And the Tim Hardaway thing too, like that's, you know, he was in his moment of still thinking about the game. He probably was like, I would love any distraction from what I just did out there. But, you know, what was the article on Tim Hardaway about?
It was just a player profile of like where yes. he kind of fit into the team at that time, because at that point it was like he'd bounced around a lot team to team, and I don't think he really like found a fit yet, because again, like he's a real quiet contributor. But everything that I remember seeing at that time, and this is one of those things where I think, you know, you have to learn to trust like your gut and what you're seeing specifically, because everything I wrote about in that story has since come to fruition. Cause like he was a really important part of that team last year. And I hope he still is this season, though. Like, I don't really want to get into Jason Kidd, but like,
We don't either.
Yeah, great. Good.
We already went on him a couple of pods ago. No.
Wonderful. Wonderful. But yeah. And like all those things have now, like, he's really leaned into that role. So it was just like, I am really interested in players like that whose stories who don't often get like a real deep dive, you know, or like a longer look, because, you know, also a lot of the times those are the people that are going to have the more interesting stories or like more circuitous way of like getting where they are, you know.
Were you at Complex at this point with those?
No, that was for Dime. So with like Complex, Dime, where else, Yahoo, Real GM, like all the other places I write for, those are just freelance opportunities. Like even with Dime, I'm a freelance features writer, but I kind of like to keep it freelance in the sense of like, not in the job security sense, because that's always a little bit scary, but just like because there's a lot of variety, you know. Like I'll write long form features for Dime, and like that's probably where the work I'm most proud of goes. But at the same time, like if I feel like, oh, actually I kind of want to do a more like analytical deep dive or like a real X's and O story, like I'll go to Real GM for that, because like that's the outlet for it. And I think, you know, I guess that's a good tip who want to get into sports writing. It's to learn what outlet likes what best and like get familiar with those editors and figure out like where your voice fits.
That's fantastic advice. I never really even thought of it that way, but you as a, you know, a varying interests and different type of approach sometimes kind of writer, you got to find the perfect outlet, the perfect audience for it. And, you know, you seem to have figured that out for sure. So we definitely appreciate that. So how did, and you went to Summer League, right, this year?
Was
this your first visit to Vegas, first visit to Summer League?
No, it was probably my fifth visit to Vegas. It was my second nice. Summer League. My first Summer League was the year before the pandemic. That was like a real overwhelming, but like very fun experience. And this year was again, real overwhelming, very fun, extremely weird just because of the pandemic and access and just the way that the league had to sort of in the last minute figure out like how many beat reporters could they admit to like a post-game scrum. And like just the best thing about Summer League is that it's super laid back typically, you know, like you don't have to tell a team that, I mean, it's always a nice thing to like reach out to a team communications and be like, hey, I want to talk to these guys after the game, but like there's no locker rooms, guys just kind of step off the court, you can grab them, you can do walk and talk. There's also all these other players there that come to see their teams. It's like a much more casual kind of button down laid back environment that obviously went out the window this year. But I would still say it definitely retains this feeling of like a very weird summer camp. almost. Yeah. And I'm not like the, like Vegas is fun and fine. I think if you're with the right people, it can also be super overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But the best thing about Summer League is like, it gives you some structure to your Vegas experience.
Agreed. No, the structure definitely helps it. One question I have, like, you know, going into, you know, the Summer League, for example, like, how do you go about like setting goals for that? Do you sit down, do you write out goals, or are you talking with, you know, other people and other writers, or like, how are you, you know, setting some goals for these, you know, events that you're going to?
The first year I didn't really, because I also knew I was going into it. I'd never experienced it before. I'd like spoken with some friends and like editors who had been there before, just to kind of get their sense of what it was like, but everybody works differently. So I left it, you know, purposefully loose. I went down with Yahoo, but like at that time there really wasn't that much interest in the Raptor Summer League team. So they were kind of like, well, if there's like a good opportunity or a good story, like feel free to turn something around. And a few of the other places were all that I wrote for were just like, no, we don't want Summer League stories. Which is like very sad to me.
Andy and I are huge fans of Summer League.
So yeah, right. Yeah. But like that kind of left me a lot of room to just feel it out for myself, which was good because I ended up like meeting a ton of people, team side, agents, you know, other writers. And it ended up just being a really like, and by the end of it, I was like, okay, I could see how I would structure this. Like I had my little routine. Like I'd get up and do something in the morning, sort of like quote normal in Vegas, which is just like try and go get a coffee somewhere. Yeah. Like, yeah.
To get that cup either.
Yeah, exactly. And then like head to the arena and like, you know, kind of ping pong between gyms to watch games. I mean, so like the most fun thing about Summer League too is like watching basketball and like watching Summer League style basketball. And sometimes I do that in media row. Sometimes I would meet up with friends and go sit with them in the arena. And I think that was important too, to just like see it from different perspectives. It was cool. I did end up like having really incredible run-ins with like coaches and players and things like that, but I didn't end up writing a ton off of it. But going into this summer league, because I also think I had like another year and a half of like covering games and, you know, more close up experience under my belt. I went again with Yahoo Sports Canada, and this time because of the Raptors, you know, top 10 pick, like it's Scotty Barnes. There's a lot of interest in the Raptors Summer League team. So we'd had a meeting before, like, okay, this is the kind of stuff like I'd like to try and like fit in a couple Q&As. I want to do a player profile. I'll do like a team recap, you know, like a kind of a first last look at the Raptors Summer League team, especially with Kyle Lowry leaving, like, how's this team going to fit with the regular Raptors team? And like, what are we kind of looking at for like the shape of the team to come? So that was better because I actually did have a plan, and I found that was a bit of a relief, especially going into Vegas during COVID, you know, to have a plan to be like, this is a work trip. Like I will see friends and like do things kind of minimally, but like, I was so busy. I ended up like getting a couple phone interview opportunities while I was there as well. And like having to turn around a couple stories for Dime. I wrote a feature on Xavier Tillman, who came and played for the Grizzlies alongside Desmond Bane. And like that story I really loved because those two and that whole rookie class never got their summer league. So talking to guys about how much like it meant for them to actually go back. Like I thought they'd be like, no, I don't know. Like we played a season in the NBA. Like we don't care about summer league, but they were all like, no, like we wanted a summer league. Like we're so happy to be here, which I thought was just like a super sweet and cool thing. But yeah, I liked that a lot better because it's like I try and watch games and like the first couple of days I'm there, and if there's a player that kind of stands out to me for whatever reason, to be like, I'm gonna write about this guy, and that's what I tell him. That was cool. But yeah, I mean, it ended up being infinitely more busy than I thought it would be. Like I thought I'd turn around like two stories, but I think I came out of there with like, I've got to turn around, like I'm still turning around stories, but like, you got to turn around like five features off of it. But it's good because like, that's what I wanted. And just to go back to what I talked about earlier, like having not had that for so long, I think I was also super keen to just like dive right back into it.
Yeah, and like you've alluded to, summer league's a little bit different vibe and environment than the normal regular NBA season. And scrums, you've referenced a couple times. It's ironic because scrums are designed to get answers, but they're like the worst place to get the answers because like the guys when they're in the scrum obviously aren't like really trying, like you're saying, cantankerous answers from our boy Kyle Lowry. But you know, summer league's the perfect place to get those answers and find people, you know, just walking around town. Honestly, they're all around there. We had a summer there and had a lot of fun just rubbing shoulders with people. But yeah, like I mentioned earlier, you're the great humanizer. And I think, you know, you do a great job of finding little tidbits that make people, you know, more interested in the person as much as the basketball player. And one of those guys, like you mentioned, Scotty Barnes, you posted a picture of him striking a pose at the end of a three, and like that kind of hijinks and goofiness. Like I love that side of the NBA. Like I'm always looking at the bench, seeing what dudes are doing and stuff, you know, and, you know, falling in love with, you know, a taco fall antic or two. But, what was Scotty like? Did you get a good amount of time with him for the feature and stuff?
The feature I'm actually going to write about. I'm going to write about Delano, but Scotty, okay. I did get to talk to. Scotty's super sweet. He's so excited. I think like my biggest takeaway of that summer league, like of the team, inclusive of like Scotty, Delano, now Precious, Ish Wainwright, who like the Raptors signed later. They like each other so much. Like they're just so happy to be playing together. And I, as a person who like, you know, loved Kyle Lowry, to me, like was the Toronto Raptors, you know, like I feel like my fandom and like his trajectory of the team was just always intrinsically kind of linked from the start. So to see him leave, well, I definitely made my peace with it. I was a little bit like, you know, what is this team going to look like? And like, what are they going to mean to me? But I think going and seeing these guys and meeting some of them in Vegas and just like seeing how excited they are, you know, not just for the opportunity. I mean, one, to come back to Toronto, because that's something that, you know, the team didn't get last season. Yeah. And then to already be playing together and to like really genuinely like each other so much. I don't know. It was like a very hopeful, it was like a super hopeful vibe. So I think I'm pretty excited. I also love how Raptors fans like had immediately turned on Scotty and were like, this is the wrong pick. Like we wasted the pick. And now they're like obsessed with him. Yeah. And I love him so much because I don't know, it would be hard not to.
Scotty's from down here in Florida, you know, and I've been watching Scotty since he was a sophomore in high school, you know, and what he's been able to do with the programs. And, you know, you saw an elite player in him, and even going to Montverde and taking, you know, having to play with other like NBA guys and taking a back seat and fitting in, like he's going to be that type like that does some great things in Toronto. So I'm super excited for you guys up there with that. And is there anything like you would say, you know, kind of about the team, like, is there a player that, you know, stuck out to you at summer league that, you know, wasn't really talked a bunch about?
Yeah, I think Ish Wainwright, honestly, like he's really intriguing to me just because like, you know, in NBA, unfortunately in like NBA years, like people consider him old and it's like, he just is getting a start at a different time. But having played overseas for a couple seasons, like he's going to come into it intrinsically a little bit tougher. You know, they just play a much more physical game there. And I think that's going to be something super worthwhile to the Raptors because like there's huge void still in losing, I think, Mark Gasol and Serge Ibaka that weren't necessarily addressed the best way last season. I really like Delano just because he has like, he's from Toronto. Like he's from Rexdale, just like a suburb outside of the city. And like, he's so happy and proud to be able to come back. I just feel like that's a really interesting story. Precious, I was kind of like really impressed by. Like, I guess I admit that like, I didn't watch him so much in Miami, but I also was like, I don't think he played that much for the Heat last season, but just like, he's coming in almost. What struck me is like he's already a very complete player on the floor, but the thing he talked about most was how excited he is to come into the Toronto system because it's a system that really primes guy versatility and like pushes them and develops them. I thought that was just like super cool. And that's like a kind of a through line that I'd say all these guys talked about. It also helps that they're all like extremely tall, have extremely like long wingspans, and they just are like, this is just going to be a team of gigantic, really nice guys who like each other and are like almost positionless. It's like Masai Ujiri's dream team if it all works out, because they all just sort of look like they look like the OG prototype. And OG Ananobi to me is like also one of the most intriguing and like, frankly, like I think best players that the Raptors have.
Yeah, we're hoping he has a little bit of comeback season. He had a little bit of slump last year, but he's definitely got it in him. You guys have a great young talented squad between Boucher, Siakam, OG, Van Fleet. I'm a big Seas fan, so I'm a little nervous of the Raptors and everyone sleeping on them still, especially throwing Scottie Barnes in the mix as a 6'9" point guard. But everyone kind of knows there's the two kind of courts that everyone's playing on there, Thomas and Mack Center and Cox Pavilion. Did you have a favorite by the end of your time there, or do you prefer one or the other kind of thing?
I think Cox is my favorite just because you couldn't this year, like their media seating was like way up in the rafters basically, but on a normal year it's like baseline seating. Mm-hmm. So guys would just be like flying into your laptop if you weren't paying attention, like falling out of bounds or the ball would be coming like right at you, just to be able to like get that much closer to the game. And if you're just even like sitting in the stands there, like you could look over and you're like this year, like, oh, that's Bam. Brad Stevens is over there, like everybody is just kind of like scattered all throughout. Like Thomas and like the big arena is great. And I like, it's good for really primetime games. I was in the big arena my first summer league when the earthquake hit. It was like Zion's first game and the earthquake hit and Kawhi would later leave Toronto. But I remember looking up at the Jumbotron and it was like swinging like a pendulum, and me being from Toronto and like not having much experience with earthquakes, I was just like, what is going on? But like that was a very memorable first summer league experience for sure. But yeah, I think the Spall Arena, there's just a lot of energy in there.
Oh yeah. It's like watching a high school game full of NBA players, and the whole sideline is like all NBA players, exactly. All their friends, guys in town working out, coaches. It's intense. And you also get a little bit better scope of like, oh, that dude's that big.
Yeah. I think that's honestly lost, right? Or like sometimes I think like how hard. Like that sounds so simple, but like how hard it is to do what these guys do. Like you definitely have a sense of that when you're that close up to it.
Absolutely.
Definitely, yeah. The speed of the game and everything.
Did you have any time with the G League team at all when Coach Stackhouse was there?
I'm trying to think. No, unfortunately. I did when Jamma was there, and I'm so sad. I'm so happy for Jamma that he's going to the Warriors because they desperately need development coach, and that's exactly what he'll do to them. And he's just like the kindest person I've ever met, kind of. But no, I didn't get to see Stack in that capacity, and I really wish I had because I like him so much.
they had an awesome staff, and they did such a good job with developing Van Fleet and Siakam. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I had a lucky opportunity to work with one of their assistants at the time was Donnie Tindall. I'm not sure if you know that name or anything, but he was with 905 at that time too. So yeah, that program and, just seeing the players you guys have pushed through, I mean, I have so much hope for the future, like you're saying with, the guys that you mentioned, and so that's going to be a really exciting time for the Raptors. And so I guess, my last question that I have, moving forward and for the season, is there, what do you kind of project for Scottie Barnes, his first season? What do you see for him?
I like love and hate these kinds of things because I feel like no don't pressure. Put so much pressure on these guys. You know what I mean? Like, no, it's like, that's just, it's why I love and hate the draft, because I think so much stake gets put into it. And like, again, we want to talk about like linear progress. The idea is that like, these guys have to be all of a sudden like the best player they're ever going to be in the first year of their careers. Like it's not realistic and it's not fair. Not to knock your question, but that's how I feel about just like the draft process overall. But I think, with Scottie, you're right. Like he's in good hands. Like the Raptors have like a pretty storied developmental system. Like they were one of the first teams that really had to use their G League team. Granted, it was like out of necessity, right? If like guys don't want to sign, what are you going to do? Like you have to develop, you really have to develop, your prospects that you're also like going to weird different places and kind of finding out of, like diamonds in the rough, if you will. But I think that it seems like he's in really good hands. I have to say like Patrick Mutombo as a coach, fits that team, like fits that group of guys so well. because he's just tough enough on them, but then he can like very easily just break into just like really beautiful and like warm stories about them. And I think like, you know, one thing he told me at Summer League was just like, well, we like hard, he said, hard work is hard. He's like, I know that sounds simple, but like hard work is hard. And like, that's what we stress to them. But he's like, if we're not performing in the same way we're asking them, then we're not really setting a good example. He's like, we have to do all the things that we're asking them to do, or like, this is a two-way system. It's not going to work. I feel like hearing that someone like Scotty Barnes is in incredibly good hands. And I wish, I like, that's something I wish for like all guys that got drafted, because we also know that unfortunately a lot of guys' opportunities and chances and the way they get developed only goes as far as what the team, where the team is at.
Yeah.
So if you get into a system that's like, you know, the Lakers aren't trying to develop players, you know, the Warriors weren't until this season. Now it's kind of out of necessity because they look at like Clay and Steph and Draymond and they're like, oh, what's our plan for after this? Like, what do we do now? You know, so it's like development comes out of, I think, unfortunately, necessity still. My hope is that it will change to be a little bit more broad and encompassing for every NBA team to realize like you should do both well, you know, because, you know, you maybe you have a team full of stars, but like, what's the, like, this is a league that moves so fast, you know, like what's next for your team? So I think like, just hearing, yeah, hearing Mutombo say that and like seeing the shape of the team, I feel like they're already going into training camp in the regular season just in a very good place. I also think it sucks because I would have loved to see Kyle Lowry. Like that's a relationship I think both players would have done really well with. And like Lowry, especially in his latter years with the Raptors, really grew into like, I don't want to say a softie, but like, he clearly loves bringing guys along and like seeing them push themselves and get to a point where like, they're not just incredibly good on court, but they're also making a real difference in their own personal lives and the lives of the people around them. So that kind of sucks. But I also think that like Fred VanVleet really took up that approach to things. So I think like with Fred and OG and like even like Boucher and Ken Burch and some of the other kind of second gen guys, that Scotty's in a really, he's in a really good place. Like he's in a really good atmosphere. And I think the franchise already values him incredibly highly, but they also treat him very realistically, which I think is important too.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you're saying, he's extremely young. He is not the finished product he's going to be when he's 24, 25, 26, he's going to be a monster probably by then in terms of a problem for everyone else in the league. And I think you hit the nail on the head. I think a guy like FEV, you know, he could step in and kind of take that leadership role from Lowry. He seems very much that kind of like mindset of player and very mature guy, you know, on and off the court kind of thing. I kind of was just, you know, bopping around the Twitter head, and I was bopping around Twitter today, and I realized I'm a Locked On fan as well. Like I listen to a lot of Locked On pods, and your co-host for basketball was Locked On Raptors.
Yeah.
But Locked On Raptors Twitter account is suspended.
Is it?
Yeah, and I was curious if you had like the answer to that mystery, because I came across that today. I was like, what on earth could Locked On Raptors have done to get suspended?
I mean, like, I'm gonna text him right now, and I'll get you the answer. So we may have to circle back to it depending on when he gets back to me. I have no idea. I got the answer from Sean. He said, a bunch of the network accounts got hit when we shared a bunch of similar promo tweets for a draft show from all the accounts at the same time.
Oh, so they got like the boss suspension or something. That's funny. Yeah. Okay. No, that's funny. I was like, what? Like, how on earth could have Locked On Raptors have even said that triggered that one? That's cool. That's cool.
I was like, Sean can be like, Sean can say some stuff, but nothing that's like suspension worthy.
Yeah, so I guess people keep an eye on that. They'll be back soon. I'm sure David Locke is calling, you know, our guy Tyler, or what's his name?
He's on it.
Jack Dorsey right now, and giving him an earful or something. Last question I'll leave you, because I know you're you know, a day one Raptors fan, quite literally. Who's your favorite Raptor ever, since you've kind of been able to follow the whole thing? I mean, you got Kyle, might be a little recency bias, but maybe you know, T-Mac, Vince. I know Vince didn't really leave on the greatest of terms, but
I feel like I have one almost for like each iteration of the actors. I think originally it was Vince, because I think, like, I mean, Stoudemire probably first, just because it was like, who's this guy? Like, you know, he was a fun player to watch as a kid, right? Like, he just really was. I think Vince, I never like took it as a knife to the heart, as I think a lot of people did. You know, I especially now retrospectively, like, I understand why he did what he did at that time. I was at the game when he came back and he finally didn't get booed and he got a standing ovation and he cried and like everyone was crying. Like, it was so cathartic. And I feel like a real like full circle that needed to happen. And I'm so glad I was there for that. And then, yeah, I mean, my favorite Raptor ever is Kyle Lowry, but I also have an incredibly soft spot for Amir Johnson. Just because like he was one of these kind of quintessential Toronto players who like, he loved being here so much and like he embraced the city. He like went to like, there was this dumb thing that happened every year called like the Toronto Zombie Walk, and Amir would just show up at it and like not tell anyone because it was like pre-social media, so he would just like show up in like full makeup because he's like, I like this kind of stuff, you know, like he would just be out in the city and like doing stuff and meeting fans and just like really embraced it. And I feel like at that time, any player that did that, people just were like, I'm obsessed with you, like you want to be here, right? Like, that's you're crazy. Buying into it. But yeah, I think like all time it's Kyle Lowry, just because of like what he did for the franchise. Like, he changed the shape and the way that it's perceived. And I think as like a Toronto sports fan too, that's something that, you know, Toronto sports fans have a real chip on their shoulder about. But more than that, to just be able to see, like, I've never experienced that with a player where you kind of see the maturation of their entire career, you know, like you see someone arrive and they're a really like, you know, at that time he was like almost considered toxic, right? When he first arrived, like he was this guy you heard like coaches had a hard time with, like impossible to coach, blah, blah, blah. He didn't think he was going to be sticking around at all. And then DeMar DeRozan approaches him and it's just like, hey, like, I need, like, do you want to buy in? Because if you buy into this, like, I need someone to do that with me. And I am. And like, I mean, I love DeMar too. I felt so angry when I like was so mad at the franchise for months of the championship season. But yeah, like, I think to just see Lowry go from that to like this kind of co-leadership role with DeMar, to like seeing his best friend get traded away, and then to like seeing his best chance to win in Kawhi and basically like handing this team that he built over, and then to become this like really selfless leader, you know, and someone who just like cared so much about the players that were coming up after him. It was just like, yeah, I've never seen that with a player, and I don't know that I will again, just because of like where I'm also at in like my own kind of fandom. But just to see him like, I guess just like really grow up with the team, you know, and like give to it everything. Like, you can't give more than what he gave. Like, no player can like give more than what he gave to it. So yeah. Also, he's just like, he's so much fun. You want a player that like annoys the shit out of everybody else to like be your favorite player in the league.
I can certainly relate with that. You know, Marcus Smart just signed his extension, similar kind of
there you go.
Career arc. We're hoping it ends with a little championship at some point, but yeah, that's definitely relatable. But you know, we don't want to take up too much of your night. We know we all basketball fans here, and we got a summer league championship that's tipping off. So, but do you have anything you want to plug? Obviously, we got the how is the at for basketball? Is it just UHH basketball, right?
Or
UHH?
You should know that, right? Yeah, no, it's with two H's. Yeah, you can follow that Dishes and Dimes podcast as well. I'm on Twitter at whatevs, WTEVS. I also have a newsletter called Basketball Feelings that's on Substack. And you can find most of my work at Dime. Nice. That feels like a good amount of things to plug.
that's certainly, I mean, you got a lot on your plate for sure. You're wearing several different basketball hats and different types of hats. That's awesome. But yeah, we definitely appreciate your time. And I think you have a pretty remarkable, awesome journey to where you are today. And we're excited to see what you do next. So we're big fans.
Thank you so much, guys. And thank you so much for having me and letting me kind of ramble into the weird trajectory that I took to get here.
Oh, that's what it's all about. That's what we're here for.
For real. Like, thanks for like answering a DM from a random human being that has, you have no idea who they are. So thank you for that. For real.
I love that kind of stuff, except the gross and weird ones. But like, yeah, the nice ones, I love that.
Yeah, never that. But yeah, no, I appreciate you for real coming on. This is, it's been great. And this is something true that like I want to show to some of the students that I've worked with, you know, because so many have had these creative minds and, you know, they just didn't necessarily, I guess, have a story like yours that's super creative that could be like, oh, dang, maybe I can. That like sparks that idea for them, you know, that they can then apply it to what they love. So I'm definitely going to be using this. And thanks again for real for coming on. I really appreciate you.
So. No, that's really nice. I feel just, yeah, I just feel super flattered. And again, thank you both so much for reaching out and for having me.